Welcome to the Mad Tech Podcast from ExchangeWire, bringing you the latest news and views from the world of ad tech, media, and marketing.
Hello, and welcome to today's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast, your weekly dive into the depths of the media landscape. I'm delighted this week to be joined by Rachel Smith, ExchangeWire CEO. Rachel, welcome back.
Thank you very much. I feel like I'm becoming a podcast regular again.
I know you're becoming part of the new furniture in the studio.
The new studio furniture. Proud to be so.
Excellent. Well, glad to have you as always. And we are both delighted to be joined by Samara Hachihara from The Telegraph. Samara, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It's a great way to start with my very first podcast.
Hey, this is your podcasting debut. We are very pleased to have offered you the space, and I'm sure you'll be a natural. So looking forward to our conversation. Well, we're going to dive into a lot of publishing news, actually, which is, you know, useful having you here, Samara. It's been an interesting week for it. And we're going to start with licensing or litigating. There's the media landscape's changing, the AI companies are scraping content, and companies seem to be choosing between the dividing line of whether to join hands with them and license their content or to sue them, for want of a better word. They are taking them to court for scraping content illegally. We're talking New York Times versus OpenAI. We're talking about Microsoft and Penske versus Google, and News Corp versus Perplexity, among many other of the legal cases. But then there's also people teaming with Microsoft. There is Condé Nast teaming with Amazon, and lots of deals with OpenAI. So it's really interesting how the chips are falling regarding AI. Come to you first, Samara. What do you think is the best route to go down, essentially?
There's no like one right way, in my opinion. I think it depends on the size of the publisher, their objectives, how much resources they want to invest on, like going to the suing way or like making a deal. Of course, like by making a deal, they're going to get some money, they're going to have access to resources and things like that. But for me, it really depends. In thinking about like the bigger publishers that have been suing, the bigger companies that have been suing, they will have the time and the investment if the process keeps like just dragging down for a really long time. They have the resources to carry on that. With smaller publishers, that is going to just like drain their resources. So it really depends on like what each publisher will want to take out of it.
Yeah. What do you think, Rachel?
So I just think this is a really interesting point in time for publishers, because it feels very similar to obviously the early days of search and how publishers and you know, digital information consumption and digital news consumption and how publishers navigated that landscape. And so as Samara says, I think it obviously comes down to a publisher's overall strategic approach and what their business model looks like. But I think this article is an example of how we're seeing a clear twin track approach. There are those publishers that are going firmly down the litigation route, you know, obviously concerned about retaining, you know, copyright ownership of their you know, no doubt hard-earned, independently produced content. And then there are publishers that are going down the deal negotiation route, and there will be lots of reasons as to why that's beneficial depending on which publisher you are, right? So, you know, I think that because this is a bit similar to the early days of search, what we really need to recognise is the world has changed significantly since then. So I think that if you are a publisher that is looking to do deals, some kind of licensing arrangement, then you probably are in a very strong position to enable yourself access to lots of interesting things. So first, obviously, it's going to potentially open up a line of revenue, a very initial, immediate line of revenue for you that you might not otherwise have or might be being compromised. I think the second thing is that you probably then open the door to allowing yourself quite early access to working with a number of these AI companies to understand how their scraping tools work, what their sort of education programs look like, if the argument is that they want to use your content to train up their, you know, their AI tool, well, then what does it actually look like? And that could give you quite a strong advantage, I think, as a publisher. On the other hand, it's absolutely right and proper that you protect your IP and that you protect, you know, the, as I said, hard work that you and all of the journalists that you employ have put into producing this content. But you probably need to, you know, at the moment, I think what we're seeing is some examples of publishers who are kind of going down one path or the other path. I think you probably need a bit of a combination approach. And I think you need to get yourself into, now it sounds like I'm lecturing you. I just mean in general for publishers. I think publishers need to get themselves into a position of confidence around this. So and that's what I mean when I say that we are in a significantly different world compared with the early days of search. I actually think that we're now in a position where publishers from a technical standpoint understand what they're getting themselves into and what the potential compromises could be to their business models. So I think what they need to do is be getting in a very confident position, understanding exactly what their monetization model looks like and what their business model looks like, so that they can go to some of these AI companies and say, well, look, we'd be willing to do a deal, but, you know, it needs to be along these prescribed lines. And as soon as anything steps outside of that, litigation is going to be one of the tools that we will revert to. Because I think there is room to move here, and I think publishers are really in a strong position. Now, obviously, some of this, I mean, the list in this article of how many pieces of litigation are underway with all of the AI giants and, you know, big tech giants, so Google included in this, obviously, concerning their AI overviews, is really long. So there's a lot of activity underway at the moment with publishers fiercely trying to protect their ground and establish a new protocol. So I kind of think that, you know, we're definitely in a moment in time where we'll see how some of these legal cases unfold. But I think this all puts publishers in a position where they need to be confident of their own, of the ground that they occupy, and be using this opportunity to their advantage. So, you know, I would think immediately coming out the gate and suing AI tools is not necessarily going to give them the results that they want, but it could be used as a tactic to get more favourable licensing agreements, and it could also be used as a fallback if those conversations don't go in the right direction. And yeah, what I was going to say, sorry, I'm getting a bit long-winded now. What I was going to say is obviously there is a value to collective behaviour and collective responses here. So you could see that there's probably, it's probably tempting for a lot of publishers to join forces and embark on some litigation activity. But I think that more could be done by joining forces to actually protect the entire industry and protect publishers of all sizes and shapes. But in order to do that, you need to really understand your strategic priorities.
Yeah, I'm going to pick each of you up on something that you mentioned there. Rachel, I'll start with you. The value exchange between the publishers and AI, the publishers need to be really wary about selling the family silver for the quick buck here, for the AI bubble, for signing deals that in perpetuity weaken them? Should it be a consideration?
So I don't, 100%. So I don't think these need to be, I don't think these should be straightforward access licensing agreements. I think these need to be actually quite complex agreements that serve the purpose of protecting those assets whilst also being able to monetize those assets. So I think, unlike the early search days, we're not just saying, well, here you can have access to our content as long as you put a link on your social media platform and pay us a bit of money for that. I think what you're saying is we've got essential content that you need in order to train your AI tools and to make sure that they're good quality. And so what are you going to give us for that? There needs to be significant financial compensation, but there also needs to be lots of fail-safes in there that allow you to review that agreement in 1 year, 1 year's time, 3 years' time, 5 years' time, allows you, like I said, access to, you know, the complexity of the technology that you're dealing with, allows you to, I don't know, carve up the monetization proposals around access to this content in a variety of different ways. So some of it could be licensing, some of it could even be some kind of advertising rev share, right? I know that it's early days, but but we're all expecting LLMs to come with some form of advertising. Well, why shouldn't publishers be a part of that conversation in the same way that, you know, advertisers are going to want their products to be surfaced? So I think publishers are in a much, much stronger position now than they ever were before. And what I'd like to see is publishers not feeling backed into a corner where the choice is either allow AI tools and LLMs access to your content or kiss goodbye to the revenue and the traffic. There's got to be an intermediary. And, you know, we're going to come on to another story in a minute that I think is a little bit connected to that. I also think it's going to be crucially important to that AI search experience. I don't know about you guys, but what I'm looking for is references to quality news brands and quality, you know, quality content so that I can feel confident that the results that I'm getting are true and verified.
Yeah. Samara, any thoughts on that?
Yes. So I agree with absolutely everything you said. And I think one thing that the publishers need to start thinking about when they are making these deals as well is thinking about like what is going to be the future dependency on the revenue coming from the LLMs, because it's great that we're going to be like these publishers will start providing quality and trusted content to train the LLMs. But thinking about this as a user, the more I use LLMs on my day-to-day or the responses that we get from AI, the easier it's getting for me and the less I see that I go straight to a publisher.
Yep.
What is it going to become in the future? Will publishers become just like news agencies that provide articles to train LLMs and people don't go to the publishers straight anymore?
Yep.
to consume their content. So the more they rely on the revenue coming from LLMs, the worse it's going to be to come back from that. So yeah, I agree when you say like the publishers are in a very strong position now because we can decide where this is going to be in a few years' time.
Yeah. And what position it fulfills in your monetization model, right? Like you raise a really good point there, Samara. It can't be the only source of revenue, and it can't be revenue that then, you know, cannibalizes your revenue streams that are associated with you as a standalone brand, site, app, whatever it might be. And it leads to something that's come up quite a bit in conversations over the last couple of weeks. I think I was moderating a panel session at First Party Capital Spotlight event last week, and we were talking about the sophistication of data tools that are enabling publishers to really offer up quality signals to audiences. And this is something I've chatted with some of your colleagues at The Telegraph about recently as well, is that I think that speaks to the fact that publishers now need to think of themselves as brands, right? They're not just providers of content and information. You are a standalone brand. You need to be then interacting with your customers and your readers in the same way that a brand would. So you need to continue going down the path of really sophisticated data infrastructure to make sure that you know as much as you possibly can about your audiences so that you can talk about the value that those audiences bring to advertisers, but also the value that those audiences bring to your own business, because it'll help you create other products and offerings that will keep people coming back to your website or your app or whatever it is that you might design in terms of other product offerings. And I think I can see a world where if we're mostly operating in AI-driven search, which is an LLM environment or something, you know, that search engines use to filter results like Google's, current AI tools, that if you think about it, that experience isn't very satisfying at the moment. Like it's good for getting information, but it's not very visually interesting, or it doesn't come with all the other things that you get when you consume newspapers, even if it is a digital version of a newspaper. So I think there's still going to be strong desire for the rest of that stuff, whether it's, you know, whether it's more complex information and more detailed information, videos, you know, images, imagery and other products. And so where is all of that going to sit? You know, is that going to end up sitting somewhere within an LLM in the way that happened with search? Probably not. I think here's a wonderful opportunity for publishers to think about ways in which they continue to attract people to their own sites or their own apps. That's not going to be an easy job. But brands are in the same position, right? They're thinking, well, okay, are my products just going to end up being sold via some sort of click or button within an LLM search environment? So therefore, do I even still need a website? Well, you're going to need something. You're going to need all of that beautiful branding, imagery and product placement to get people interested in what you've got. And I think publishers need to be thinking about themselves underneath exactly the same banner.
You mentioned audience and community there, and I'm going to take that as a jumping off point into our next story. I love the headline of this one. Reddit's tip for publishers: contribute without disrupting the vibe. Reddit seemed to be having a bit of a moment. I did one of our coffee woods the other week with Chloe Singleton from 8&4 Agency, and she spoke about the importance of Reddit in community building and how it's being used a lot more, and how publishers are and brands are really trying to get involved in Reddit communities. And this advice from them is, you know, to be natural when they're using the platform to build their communities. Really, really interesting. Their referral traffic to news brands was up 220% from 6 million at the start of 2019 to over 19 million in July this year. And the platform has seen its monthly UK audience rise 27% year on year since May. So it's doing good things for publishers, having a bit of a moment. Samara, how do you think publishers can really use Reddit to their benefit?
I think it's a really good way to build trust with a potential new audience that is not reading the specific publication. So publishers have the subject experts in the editorial team, and thinking about especially with the increase of subs first business, where the business are trying to increase the number of subscriptions, but regular and more engaged readers. And at the same time, we have this communities where a lot of readers go to for a type of specialized advice, feedback, some kind of similar to that. So I think it's a huge opportunity for publishers to start reaching out outside their platforms in a more relevant way to the readers. So of course we can use SEO strategy or paid marketing strategy in all of that, but we rely on attention. The message that publishers can drive through all those channels, it is very small. So it's more relevant and more engaged if they are actually driving this conversation, not driving, but being part of the conversations with these users, understanding other perspectives, offering their view, but becoming part of the community. And the point about not disrupting, it's interesting because it's a huge shift in a cultural shift, a power shift, where today publishers are very used to they write and the audience comes to them to read what they want. And with Reddit, as soon as they enter that space, they need to respect the rules of that space, the culture of that is part of that community, and be respectful, collaborate with the readers, the users, without just imposing their perspective, their view, or the publisher side of the story. So for me, it's being specialists in really focused on the trust that they can build with that specific community that can attract more readers to the publication.
Yeah, I think that it's the embodiment of the "Hello, fellow children" meme. It's, how do you go into a space without sticking out like a sore thumb, mm-hmm. and completely, being found out for making this authentic communicative space completely inauthentic by just bringing a sales and brand message to it. I think it's a delicate balance. Rachel, how do you see, how can publishers in particular get involved in Reddit communities?
I mean, I thought what was really interesting in this article was the statement that Redditors, as they're called, and I'm saying this like an ancient person because
authentic.
I just exactly. So I would be that person that walks in and goes, "Hello, Redditors." I mean, I've got no idea about Reddit. Like, it pops up sometimes in, you know, search results, and that's it. That is my only experience with it. But I think that it's fascinating that the article said that that users of the platform and people within the communities are really hungry for news, verified news, information, news sites, you know, and want to consume that content. So I think that's brilliant, right? That should be music to publishers' ears, the idea that there are entire, you know, verified communities of conversations going on in a social media platform, or I guess that's what you call Reddit, a social media platform, where they've got a hunger for news. That's fantastic. So there has to be a way to kind of bring those two things together. I think what else is interesting about this, though, is that this is very community-led and community-driven. Makes me wonder what happens on publishers' own websites regarding commentary and interaction with articles, because there's obviously almost always the opportunity to engage in those ways. But this is a completely different platform. So as you said, Samara, it is the opportunity for publishers here is to connect with a new audience, a fresh audience that they wouldn't be connecting with otherwise. So I think that the challenge then is finding the best way to do that. And I guess if I were a publisher, I'd be delegating that to people that work for me that spend a lot of time on Reddit because I imagine they'd know best how to get involved in the conversation. And I mean, the article brings up a couple of practical suggestions of how to do that. You know, there's all sorts of ways that you can use the Reddit platform to, understand what type of topics are being discussed and understand the key messages within those discussions and how to get involved in that community. So I wonder if then it means that publishers are going to be more and more employing people that have got those skills, those specialist skills. You know, how do we create some kind of community of our own as well around the content that we publish as a publisher and the content that we're producing as a publisher? And then how do we get engaged in other social media environments with that content? And for Reddit, it clearly would require a big, like you've said, listening and community-based set of skills, and so employ people that have got those skills is what I would be saying.
Yeah, and I think we are seeing more and more publishers hiring community managers as well. It's like a focus area that I noticed that is
growing.
Yeah. And one threat that I would say is that, especially in our industry in advertising, we talk about like how brands need to build their assets and talk to the audience in different ways based on the channel or on the device you are. And you still see like the majority of brands like making mistakes with that and just like assume that once they publish on what they publish on web is exactly the same experience that the users will take for every single channel.
Yeah.
So, one point for me is publishers, if that's the way that they want to go, the route they want to go, to make sure that they have like a specialized team, as you said, like hiring people that are all like active on Reddit, but hire people that will be able to interact without the high level of editorial approval and overseeing, because it's like a faster environment. The way that you interact and you have to respond to things is a lot faster. You don't have the time to write something and have like layers of like approvals in the editorial team like we have with content in general. So it needs to be something faster, like it happens with social media, but on a lot deeper level, because social media is going to be like more quick responses, shorter responses. And then with Reddit, you probably, if you want to go through the expert advice, expert person on that subject matter, you have to be able to come up with the alignment is still having alignment with the brand you're representing, but being able to provide the quick feedback to the readers.
Yeah. Go on.
And making a link to what you mentioned before about publishers being brands now. I recently saw a presentation of Eugene Healy at a conference that I was last week, and he was talking exactly about this and how publishers can leverage the resources that they have, like the journalists, to become the visual representation of the brand and attracting more people to their brand. And there's a lot of publishers that are giving like the goal to journalists to become more like influencers or like being very active on social media. This is a huge opportunity to explore more of that as well. Of course, like there is the question of like when the influencer or the journalist becomes bigger than
the brand.
The publisher brand. Yeah. But I still think that is a really good way for publishers to attract new audiences to the channels.
I completely agree. And I've been thinking about this quite a bit recently too, because I'm finding myself following journalists on Instagram and TikTok, and there are some really interesting journalists, not necessarily young people either, certainly people my age and older, very experienced journalists. I can think of one that is a reporter for CNN. He's British but based in Washington. And he's got great completely accessible, fantastic social media clips that make me, well, they make me want to read more of his stuff, but they also just make me want to dive a bit more into that subject. And just that tiny video gets me much more engaged in the subject. So if I was a big social media user, which I'm not, but if I were and I was on Reddit and there were other ways to engage in that topic and that conversation, and you had journalists representing, you know, the byproduct is they represent this brand, but they've got a brand in an of themselves, I think that's a great connection and a great link to make. And I think there's huge opportunities for brands, so for publishers. I'm already calling them brands. There we go, made the switch. I think that's a huge opportunity for publishers. I think really important point that you made, Samara, without being explicit, so I'll be explicit. We all know the risks associated of the individual that works for a publisher becoming bigger than the brand. Hello, Gary Lineker, BBC. And that can be a real issue. And we could also start to see a trend where those journalists and specialists become so big themselves that people then, the brand becomes sidelined as well. That could be the other risk, right? So there's lots of interdependencies going on there, but I still think that this is absolutely, given all of the technology tools that we've got at our fingertips, a moment of opportunity for publishers to think about how their journalists represent them and how they can maximise that, and then think about how they promote their own brand as well. And, yeah, I mean, it's just really nice to hear of a social media platform where there's a huge amount of demand for news content.
Yeah, I think so. I think you've both hit various nails on various heads there. I think there's a lot to that. I love the idea of it's a great authentic way to get involved, is, you know, ask me anything with your journalist and stuff like that. It's a superb way to grow the brand without having to do a like pretend Reddit language post that's actually just pushing subscriptions. It's there's smart ways to get involved, and I think it'll be really interesting to see who prospers on Reddit
and who starts doing it, right? Who gets a bit sort of you know, I'd love to see big traditional publishers and news brands come out doing some really interesting insights. So that's why I followed this CNN guy. I'm sure I've consumed some of his content and articles before, but I had no idea who he was. He's just making these great videos. I'm like, this, and you know, he makes them in the news truck outside you know, Capitol Hill in Washington. I'm like, this is fantastic. So yeah, more of it.
Just like many years ago, so I've been at Telegraph for 9 years, and I think like 1 year after I joined, the department that I was part of, they started organizing to bring journalists to talk about like what they do, because we set like on more a subscription team, so it was really important for us to understand everything that goes behind the scene. And just making the link to the Ask Me Anything, those sessions were so engaging and so interesting to hear about like the investigative journalists, like all the work that goes behind what they do, like how they spend months and months with the investigations, how they go undercover and all those things, or even the experience of like sports journalists, like how it is their day to day. We think it's like all this fancy thing, like you do what you love because you are passionate about football or like any sports you're involved in that, but how exactly it is the behind the scenes in bringing that passion that we saw they were talking about to a Ask Me Anything is like such a great way to engage with audience.
They are fascinating, typically fascinating people, especially news journalists. They've had amazing experiences. They've got such depth of knowledge about a whole range of topics and really interesting stories to tell. Makes for great social media content.
Excellent. Cool. Well, I'm going to take us full circle back to the legal world for our final story. And it's about the Great Browser War. Perplexity have launched Comet recently. OpenAI now have their own browser. And it's a lot about agentic shopping and how stuff's going. But Amazon have sent Perplexity an aggressive legal threat demanding it stops allowing its AI assistant to shop for its users. Amazon say that they have repeatedly requested Perplexity stop its Comet browser from buying products for customers. Amazon claims Comet AI provides its customers with a degraded shopping and customer service experience, while Perplexity claims this request is at odds with Amazon's values. As mentioned, this is the browser war kicking off and the agentic retail revolution. Rachel, what do you make of this request and Amazon v Perplexity?
Spoiler, whilst you were going through your intro there, it makes me laugh because, this is Amazon just not wanting anyone to get any fraction of, insert themselves in any fraction of their environment, right? They want to own the entire transaction and, they'll use any argument I think they possibly can to try to elbow anything AI-driven out of the way. And you would think that the upside for them, the potential upside for them, is any shopping tool that is buying things on their site, they could, instead of looking at it as an AI tool, they could look at it as another shopper and another customer and just focus on how they can push more products in that direction. But they clearly see it as a threat because they're developing their own tools that will be similar, and they also have a walled garden environment into which they do not want to let any other pieces of technology. And it makes me giggle a little bit because the sorts of arguments that they're using are just, we've asked them repeatedly to stop doing this. Have you now? I'm quite sure those requests have been made of you on occasions and you have firmly ignored them. So this is amusing for the moment. On a more serious note, I think it's super interesting to understand how these tools will actually work. And as you've rightly characterized, John, this isn't just about a lawsuit from an enormous tech giant to another growing, becoming enormous tech giant. This is also a story about what agentic and AI-driven shopping looks like, what those shopper tools look like, and what that environment looks like. The other thing that made me giggle a bit, though, was them saying it's a I can't remember the wording used, but intimating it's an inferior shopping environment.
Degraded.
Degraded, that's it. I'm thinking the Amazon shopping environment isn't exactly premium in my experience. But anyway, I mean, I'm not saying it doesn't work. It does work. It's all very convenient, but it's pretty pound store. So they don't really have a leg to stand on there either. But it's super interesting to watch what that looks like and to also just think about the advertising kind of and brand side complexities associated with this, because that's another layer to this story that, wasn't fleshed out in the article, is what, how the hell does AI-powered shopping agents, how do brands feel about that and what does that look like for them?
Yeah. Samara, what do you think?
This story made me laugh a bit, but not only me, like me and my colleagues were all talking about this and how funny it is that Amazon is coming up with like this reasons to threaten them. So, but it's nice in some way to see that they feel threatened by someone finally.
Yeah.
There is someone playing on the same level as them, and that brings like huge risks to the revenue generation, not only to the direct e-commerce, but also to like all the data that they have on the users that they end up like monetizing in other ways. But the thing that is interesting, that it's hard to know, it's not like I support Amazon in any way, but I think this is very important at the moment, especially being like a battle between two giants that can actually benefit smaller publishers, smaller e-commerces. Because if we think about like the power that we are giving to AI, it's like enormous. And the fact that this could impact affiliate marketing for publishers and smaller publishers, or like how in terms of like the transparency basically about like what AI is suggesting to buy, we are soon moving into a space where for your product to show up in the AI recommendation for the basket, you're going to have to pay for that as well. So you it's another thing we're going to have to pay, another revenue line that brands will have to account for in their media spend. So for me, we are giving way too much power. Thinking about like the personal data as well, I think it's another player that users are giving their personal data to. So we know, like, we are at, like, there are like way too many companies that already have our personal data, but we don't know exactly what is the future with AI, what they're gonna do with all the data that we are providing to them. So as soon as I start giving like all my personal information, credit card and all those things for them to make these decisions for me, how it will start like affecting my life and what they do with my data. Are they gonna sell my data, or are they compliant with like all GDPR and things like that, you know?
Yeah,
I sort of have to confess, I definitely fear a world where an AI agent's doing my shopping for me at the moment. But, you know, I can also remember a time where I feared buying clothes online. So, you know, exactly, preposterous to think of, for some reason, thinking that there was something wrong with that transaction. You know, it was the whole like, oh, but I can't really see it properly, and what's it going to look like, and that's going to take so long to turn up, and, you know, then I buy it online over a credit card, and what's going to happen, you know, is that safe, and blah, 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 blah. And here we are now. So I fully accept that I will be living in a world where that will probably be quite normal, but at the moment I have to say I fear it a bit.
Yeah, I can't imagine asking an agentic AI to find me another black T-shirt.
Well, but this is a thing, though. I think for me, first and foremost, it's that I don't think that I would trust them to come up with the product that I want. But, you know, maybe I'm wrong about that.
No, yeah. I still go to the shops to do my weekly grocery shopping, and I've been really judged at work recently for that. People say, I can't believe you still go to the shops, but I don't trust even another human picking the fruit and vegetables for me.
Yeah, I've gone back to that too because there's a better quality shop now in my neighborhood that sells better fruit and vegetables, and they don't do delivery. But also the other thing is as well, you know, our habits change in all sorts of microwaves, small ways all the time, right? I don't want to buy bags of stuff. I want to buy just individual things and eat them fresh. And yeah, so I'm kind of going back to old school for that. And also too, the proliferation of trendy bakeries and all of that kind of stuff means that A, you can't get it delivered so easily, and B, you know, now shopping looks like it did for me 25 years ago, where I go to this shop for that and this shop for that and this shop for that and this shop for that.
Oh, it's lovely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It takes a bit of time out of my Saturday, but it's an enjoyable experience.
Yeah, you know, the agentic AI will never be able to pick the perfectly ripe avocado in the shop.
Absolutely not. I won't trust it to do that at all.
No. Samara, you talked about, you know, the size of this legal battle, and it is not David versus Goliath. This is Goliath versus Goliath's slightly shorter mate. So how How do you see it playing out? Because these are both very well-heeled parties who could fight for a long time. Do you imagine there'll be, we'll find out 3 months down the line that there's a huge deal between Amazon and Perplexity regarding AI shopping? How do you think it plays out?
It might be the way that it goes. But what I hope is that this brings more transparency to the whole thing, to the whole AI, like how AI is impacting the whole, not only the industry, the whole, like, no, it's not the right answer. But
there are no wrong answers.
No,
but I think, like, I would hope it brings more transparency to everything that we are dealing with. Yeah, but I do think that the way it's going to go is, like, having, like, they are going to settle on a deal.
Yeah, and it circles back nicely to the first story. You know, it's like you said, Rachel, it can be the threat that's the precursor to a mutually beneficial agreement between the two.
It could be. And my fear always when that happens is that it's not usually that beneficial to the customer. but let's see, because as you've both said, maybe this is a moment in time where two enormous companies with deep pockets are developing the same technology, or maybe they just continue to go head to head. And in the meantime, we start to see a little more regulation and control around AI data and systems. And also there's got to be some other people that are developing agentic shopping tools. So, you know, if they carry on battling it out for long enough, they might find that they've got more competition as well. Not the size of each of those companies individually, but everyone's got to be building something similar to this. Anyone that's got a big e-com business anyway.
Yeah. One thing for me that needs to start moving faster is the regulation.
Mm.
Because 100%. AI moves so fast that we are taking a while to adapt to the change and properly think about, like, how do we regulate all this? What is right? What is wrong? How do we start putting, like, guardrails for everything? So that is, like, one of the things for me that needs to start picking up.
Absolutely. And I remember a couple of years ago when we were talking about probably the, the birthday anniversary of GDPR or something like that. I was chatting with some specialists and someone that works at the ICO. And one of the points he was making is that the problem is our modern lives and the technology tools and solutions that we use to get through our modern lives are so advanced and they change so fast that our education systems can't keep pace with them, our traditional education systems can't keep pace with them. And that was only a couple of years ago. And here we are 2-3 years later and things are moving so much faster than they were 2 or 3 years ago. And the acceleration of, you know, the adoption of AI tools is accelerating the pace of change. And we're still, yet our legislative processes are still just as slow as they ever were. So we really need to start to see some movement in that respect.
Yeah, I mean, in, you know, 20 years' time, we could be talking about a monopoly that could have been nipped in the bud 20 years ago. And, you know, we could be back to that kind of court case.
Yeah.
So, yes, I think guardrails and regulation is so essential. I think we could probably do another hour talking about the necessity for it. And we will someday. But for now, I'm going to wrap us up. So, Rachel, thank you so much for your time.
Pleasure.
And Samara, thank you so much for joining us. Great pod debut. Well done.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome back anytime. And thank you all for watching and listening.
You've been listening to the Mad Tech Podcast, brought to you by ExchangeWire.